They haven't taken away your voice yet. Send a message to the people from nowhere. Vote yes for them to run your station without you. Or, to keep your voice at your own local station board, vote no. It's still up to you.
Good morning. These are some of the headlines relating to the coronavirus pandemic from the WBAI News for Monday, March 16th, 2020. I'm Paul DiRienzo. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a recommendation on Sunday. It said gatherings of 50 people or more should be canceled or postponed throughout the country for the next 8 weeks because large events can fuel the spread of the coronavirus. Parts of the country already look like a ghost town. Florida beaches are closed for spring break. Starbucks is only accepting takeout orders. And the governors of Ohio and Illinois ordered bars and restaurants shuttered. New York City has been the site of some of the most dramatic events. Mayor de Blasio announced Sunday New York City schools will shut down immediately and stay closed for at least a month because of the coronavirus. With more than 1 million students, New York is the largest school district in the country. The mayor says schools will be closed until April 20th at the earliest, and he left open the possibility that schools will be closed for the rest of the school year if conditions do not improve. The mayor said, "I have no words for how horrible it is, but it has become necessary." Classes will be shut down entirely Monday, and teachers and administrators will report to work Tuesday through Thursday to plan for online learning, which will begin March 23rd. After that, the city will keep some schools open as learning centers to provide child care for essential workers, including health care workers. Education Department officials said they're working with Apple to purchase and give out up to 300,000 iPads. T-Mobile is going to work with city officials to help with internet access. Meanwhile, a growing chorus of officials has been urging Mayor de Blasio to put the city on lockdown. In response, on Sunday night, de Blasio ordered bars and clubs to shut their doors and restaurants to only serve takeout and delivery to contain the burgeoning coronavirus outbreak. "Our lives are all changing in ways that were unimaginable just a week ago," de Blasio said. And the mayor also postponed the Queensboro president's race due to the outbreak. He also conceded a curfew hasn't been ruled out either. The city announced 329 confirmed cases of coronavirus and 5 deaths as of Sunday.
WBAI New York. Coming up next, It's a Good Day.
In the morning, when the moon is at its rest, you will find me at the time I love the best, watching rainbows play on sunlight, pools of water, ice cream, cold nights in the morning. Can't you imagine it? It's the morning of my life, yeah. In the daytime, I will meet you as we.
Good morning. It's 7 a.m., 7.03 a.m. It's 7.03 a.m. You're listening to Non-Corporate Community Control, WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming globally at WBAI.org. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of It's a Good Day. Today, we will speak with Dr. Hillel Cohen, Professor of Epidemiology and Population Health at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. We will discuss the social, economic, and political dimensions of public health in the U.S., and the coronavirus outbreak. Stay tuned for headlines and the weather.
Minutes take so long to drift away. Please be patient with your life. It's only morning and you've still to live your day. In the evening, I will fly you to the moon, to the top right hand corner of the ceiling in my room, and there we'll stay till the sun shines another day. Play on clotheslines and I'll be yawning. 'Tis the morning of my life, morning of my life.
Thank you. On Saturday, the House of Representatives passed a relief bill designed to combat the spread of the coronavirus. The bill, which awaits a Senate vote, includes a provision requiring free testing. It is criticized, however, because its provision for paid sick leave doesn't go far enough. It only covers 20% of America's workforce. The bill does not cover millions of people who work for large corporations like McDonald's and Walmart. Small business employees, service workers, workers on contract, and workers who rely on tips will not be offered sick paid leave under the new legislation. And across the country, tests for the coronavirus are in short supply. Doctors and hospitals are rationing them. This means that many Americans with worrisome symptoms cannot get tested. Only those who are very sick and meet multiple virus symptoms get the test. The new bill seeks to address the issue. Here is Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz grilling the director of the Center for Disease Control on the matter at last Thursday's congressional hearing.
Saying, because you can't name anyone specifically, that there's no one specifically in charge that we can count on to make sure that people who need to be tested, healthcare workers or anyone else, there's not one person that can ensure that these tests can be administered. Yes or no?
My colleague is looking at me to answer that. Here we go.
Yep.
So very quickly, the system is not really geared to what we need right now, what you are asking for. That is a failing.
It is a failing.
I mean, let's admit it. The fact is, the way the system was set up is that the public health component that Dr. Redfield was talking about was a system where you put it out there in the public and a physician asks for it and you get it. The idea of anybody getting it easily, the way people in other countries are doing it, we're not set up for that. Do I think we should be? Yes, but we're not.
Okay, that's really disturbing, and I appreciate the information.
The federal government and many states, including New York, have suspended the visitation rights of prisoners to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. A similar move in Italy has led to uprisings at more than 30 prison facilities. By contrast, Iran, also hit hard by the virus, has temporarily released 70,000 prisoners. And last night, Governor Cuomo announced that New York City's 1,800 public schools will close and that all restaurants will be limited to takeout and delivery service only to prevent the spread of the virus. This decision will have a major impact on the city's 1.1 million students, their parents, and their 75,000 teachers. Of concern are the 100,000 students in New York who are homeless and rely on the school system for breakfast and lunch. It is unclear how long schools will remain closed. It may be until the end of the summer or, according to Mayor Bill de Blasio, perhaps even until the end of the year.
Be constructive, which is focusing on today and tomorrow. There's an old military expression that management officials use, don't fight the last war. This is not about what happened yesterday. We are looking at a new war that no one has seen before. This is a case of first impression for this nation. We have never fought a virus like this with this potential consequence. So plan forward. You see that wave? Try to reduce the size of the wave. Assume you can't reduce the size of the wave. And assume the wave breaks at a higher level than the hospital system can accommodate. I believe that's what's going to happen.
It's 36 degrees and sunny this Monday morning, March 16, 2020. It's 7:09, and I'm Johanna Fernandez. It's a good day here on listener sponsor WBAI in New York. Thank you for tuning in and listening to our show. And this is quite a different moment for New Yorkers, for the country, and for the world. there's a feeling of ominousness in the air. Folks don't know what is coming. And certainly our government has not helped us navigate through these tempestuous moments. And the question is, what have other people done in the past when the country has been in crisis? I think it's important to remember that in the 1930s, when long food lines, pantry lines were forming here in New York City and in Chicago and across the country, and when the government was waffling and not upholding the safety of Americans, people took to the streets. It was in the 1930s that the Communist Party organized collective kitchens. They also organized against evictions, and they pressed local government right here in New York to essentially provide for the basic needs of New Yorkers in the face of an economic crisis unseen before. So I think that as we move forward, and even as we're isolated in our homes, we should consider that collaboration and collective action and the spirit of solidarity will save us, and individualism will definitely sow the seeds of crisis, of deeper crisis. It's 7:11, and you're listening to listener-sponsored WBAI in New York, and we're going to get right into the substance of our show. In the meantime, here's a song you might recall.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother,
dig it.
Stop right on.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate.
You know we've got to find a way
to bring some loving here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality.
Sister,
talk to me,
sister,
so you can see,
sister,
oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh,
right on.
Judge us simply 'cause our hair is long. Can't see more.
That was What's Going On by Marvin Gaye. It's 7:16, and you're listening to listener-sponsored Community Control, WBAI, New York, at 99.5 FM in New York. In January 2020, the coronavirus developed in Wuhan, China, and spread quickly to South Korea, Europe, the United States, and across the world. Last week, the World Health Organization declared it a pandemic. At the same press conference, World Health Organization officials signaled to the rest of the world that we have much to learn from China, which has all but stemmed the spread of the virus. The country leveraged the power of the state and lowered the rate of new infection from 3,500 a day to approximately 24. In 3 days, China shut down Wuhan, ground zero of the virus. It developed a plan for mass-scale testing, building fever clinics, and mobile CAT scan units everywhere. It mandated total isolation of those infected and developed 14-day isolation regimens for those who might have been exposed. It also harnessed its country's resources unequivocally, including military personnel, to build temporary hospitals and to manufacture tests and other medical equipment. By contrast, the United States' response to the coronavirus has been catastrophic. The White House downplayed the seriousness of the virus and decided not to use the test recommended by the World Health Organization. As a result, we are shockingly behind on testing, which is needed to understand the true scope of the outbreak and how to respond. For perspective, South Korea is testing 20,000 people a day. The U.S., on the other hand, has tested less than 40,000 people in 2 months. Yes, that's less than South Korea tests in 1 day. And while we live in the wealthiest society humanity has seen, our medical infrastructure is ill-equipped to respond to a crisis that is expected to deepen in the next 2 weeks. Hospitals and doctors could be seriously overwhelmed by an influx of patients amid insufficient equipment, respirators, ICU beds, and personnel. Centered on private insurance, our decentralized for-profit system has created panic and confusion and promises death and unseen suffering in our lifetime. The question is, how did we get here? To help us understand this moment, we are happy to welcome to WBAI Dr. Hillel Cohen, who is a doctor of public health and professor of epidemiology and population health at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. Prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Dr. Hillel argued that wasted resources on bioterrorism preparedness scared people into supporting the war and diverted money from real public health needs. Before joining the faculty at Einstein, Dr. Cohen was a union activist and elected delegate in 1199 SEU's Healthcare Workers Union. Dr. Hillel Cohen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And if I may, the standard disclaimer that my institution is for identification purposes only, and my views are my own and not necessarily theirs.
Thank you for that clarification. So the U.S., I've read, has fewer hospital beds than Italy and South Korea, even though those countries have only about one-fifth of our population. Can you give us a sense of how the current healthcare system stands in the way of an effective public health response to this crisis?
One of the big problems is that what we really have in the United States is not a healthcare system, but a sick care system, where the money and the infrastructure is geared only after people are not only sick, but fairly severely sick. And there's very little emphasis on public health and prevention. With respect to the sick care system, it's further distorted by the fact that it's all for profit. And even what used to be so-called nonprofit hospitals are still run on a profit-making basis, and the insurance companies, of course, some of which used to be nonprofit, were all privatized. And it's all about the money. So the business model has been to reduce capacity to the very smallest amount that is available, you know, to maximize the usage. You don't want to have empty beds because that costs money. So they slashed hospitals, they closed down hospitals and shut down beds. Patients come in and are actually pushed out sometimes earlier than they need to be in order to have a rapid turnover, and it's all about the money. So instead of having excess capacity and adequate staffing has been cut, and the beds have been cut and so on. So, another aspect in terms of sick care versus health care, the World Health Organization and public health people in general have long been talking about what's called social determinants of health. And this means that while medical care does play a role and is important, it's not the most important determinant of who gets sick and who has serious illness. The most important determinants, the things that matter most, are the economic situation, whether people have stable jobs, stable living, a healthy living environment, shelter, education, including health education, and the fact that people are subject to racism, sexism, and other forms of oppression, etc. These, and as well as environmental problems or environmental injustice, really, that these things have a much bigger impact on impairing the health of millions of people.
Can you give us a sense of what folks in your field are saying about this moment? What's the reaction among your colleagues?
Well, I think my colleagues is a very wide community with many, many different opinions. Amongst the progressive public health people are very concerned that whatever efforts are done for mitigation, and this is a crisis situation, that we have to take into account the fact that this is going to impact, that some of the key measures of social distancing can have, which everyone agrees is pretty much the only thing we have available to us, because there is no vaccine and there is no treatment per se, only for symptoms, that the social distancing that everybody's talking about with good reason, many of these things are going to impact on people's lives in other ways. So when people are told, stay away from your jobs, stay home if you're sick, there's no paid sick time off for many people. Some employers, some government agencies will be giving paid sick time, but many, many will not. And how are they supposed to live? If people are being told, well, stock up in case you have to, stock up on food in case you have to self-quarantine. Well, so many people are food insecure that they don't have enough food for the next day, let alone to stock up for 2 weeks, et cetera, or more in case they have to stay. People are told go to work in your cars rather than public transportation. That's not practical for people in New York and many other places. And what about the people who don't have cars? These are the kinds of situations that in almost every crisis we've been through, whether it was Katrina or hurricanes, wildfires, et cetera, the usual response is, here's what you have to do to go save yourself. And the people who have the least resources are also the most vulnerable. And they are not in a position to do even those measures.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking about the psychological impact of isolation, if isolation is even possible in New York City, where many people live in very, very close quarters. But some are isolating, and I'm thinking that that creates anxiety, which then lowers our immune system. And I'm also thinking of the writings of social psychiatrist Dr. Mindy Thompson Fullilove, who writes about root shock, the impact essentially of displacement on people. She writes, and we've talked about this previously on our show, she writes that root shock undermines trust, increases anxiety, destabilizes relationships, destroys social, emotional, and financial resources, and increases the risk of every kind of stress-related disease, from depression to heart attack. Part of what you're suggesting is that our healthcare system is a sick care system, but it really doesn't establish the infrastructure in people's daily lives to create healthy bodies and minds that might be able to just handle the crisis that apparently awaits us. Can you give us a sense of how important testing is for this moment we're in?
Well, it's one of the terrible shames that tests have been so limited, because testing is important in order for people to know whether they actually have to self-isolate, not only from the community, but even from their own family. So it's very important. It's also very important to know what the denominator is, so-called, when we talk about mortality rates, or we talk about usage of hospital facilities. We have no idea where this is going, how it's going, and the lack of testing is virtually criminal. But I think the example you used about China, it may not necessarily be the blood test by itself. The blood test is extremely important, but it may not be as accurate as it needs to be, and it's going to be extremely difficult to have it in en masse the way it needs to be. And even something more simple like taking people's temperatures with thermometers, or even a lot cheaper, may be a way of initial screening. Because if people start getting symptoms like the flu, including even a mild temperature, it at least raises the possibility that they might be infected. And of course, it could be the flu, it could be a cold, but at the very least, people should be taking notice of that and trying to do as much as possible to protect their own families, their coworkers, their loved ones, and so on, by not spreading it if in fact they have it. So testing is extremely important, but it's not the only thing. Also, the Chinese example of having CT scans, where have a huge capacity, at least in the epicenter of the epidemic, which has a more definitive diagnosis, meaning they're more sure of who has it and who doesn't. These are the kinds of things that the U.S. should have the capability of doing. And even as we speak, the government should be mobilizing industrial resources to start manufacturing these things. We know that whenever there's a military action or war, and of course, we haven't really known peace for a long, long time. They have no problem in reorienting manufacturing to produce what they need for war. we need to reorient manufacturing to produce the hospital equipment, the CT scans, the testing, and whatever else is needed, the hospital beds and so on, and all the infrastructure needed to take care of this crisis. This has to be started yesterday.
Yes, I've been thinking about the reality that in the past, during World War One and during World War Two, the U.S. government literally reorganized production. They stopped the production of cars to build the apparatus of war. And that happened very quickly.
Very quickly, and they have the capacity to do it, but it's a question of the will.
Right.
And what gets in the way is that everything is done on a privatized basis. Everything is done for profit. And the concern about what needs to be done for the social good is put second. But even that may change, and I hope it does change, but we have a couple of additional problems. This is going to be different from the crisis of war. In World War II, the production, ramping up the production for war, helped get the capitalist economy out of the Great Depression.
Right.
In this case, this crisis may trigger the next Great Depression or recession or whatever, because the general business cycle we've been long overdue for a collapse. It's been, to some extent, artificially extended. The so-called Wall Street, it's always been a recession for poor people and working people who never really recovered from the 2007-2008. But Wall Street recovered, but it's been long overdue for a crash. And now it's very likely that this crisis, because so much of economic activity is going to be stopped and paralyzed, that it may trigger a major, major crash, and the recovery is not going to be that quick. The corporate interests in Wall Street are going to say, well, and the Trump administration said it's only about the pandemic that's creating this. But we probably were going to have that crash anyway, and this was just the trigger, which means that even after the pandemic starts to ease, and we hope it's sooner rather than later, but we don't know how long it'll take, but even after it's eased, we're going to be likely in the midst of a very deep and widespread economic recession, which is going to increase the suffering of working people.
You're listening to the voice of Dr. Cohen, Doctor of Public Health and Professor of Epidemiology and Population Health at Albert Einstein. I'm Johanna Fernandez, host of It's a Good Day here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, streaming globally at WBAI.org. And Dr. Cohen, as you were speaking, I was reminded that last week this happened without folks really noticing. The federal government injected $1.5 trillion to prevent, quote, unusual disruptions in the markets. So the U.S. government is willing to bail out Wall Street, but it hesitates when it comes to protecting the safety and lives of Americans.
There's always enough money to what some people have called socialism for the rich. There's always enough money to give free money. That's literally what they're doing with the unlimited zero-interest loans to the banks, free money to the wealthiest whenever there's a situation where working people need it. Subsidies, they will fight over every penny. It may be worthwhile talking a little bit about the House bill that was proposed or was passed in the House.
Yes, please.
This is a very mixed bill. The good side of it is that it puts into the public square, so to speak, and makes mainstream the notion that there should be mandatory paid sick time and mandatory family leave and extended unemployment benefits. These are all mentioned in the bill, and it is provides for and for some people, but there are at least two very big negatives with respect to the bill. One is, of all places, the New York Times pointed it out. Certainly no friend of poor and working people. But the New York Times pointed out that this bill will only cover about 25% of the official working force, because about half of workers who work in traditional jobs work for companies with more than 500 employees. And it's absolutely mind-boggling that the biggest, richest corporations are going to be exempt in this bill from having to pay family leave and sick time. And then on the other end, the smaller companies with less than 50, which are usually called small businesses and so on, they're not that small. But those, while they're not officially totally exempt, they can all apply for hardship exemptions, and they all will. So that cuts out another 25%. It also doesn't cover the undocumented. It doesn't cover people working for cash. It doesn't cover the gig economy, the Lyft drivers, the gardeners, the people who shape up in the parking lots. There's other millions who it doesn't cover. And in addition, so it really needs to be much broader for it to be effective. The other thing is that it has within it a Trojan horse. One of the ways they claim they're going to pay for it is by allowing the businesses who are being mandated to give paid sick leave and paid family leave is to absolve them, to give them credits for the payroll taxes. And it's presented as payroll taxes, but that's a euphemism. The payroll taxes are precisely those taxes that employers have to pay to help contribute to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. These are the exact so-called entitlement programs that working people should be entitled to, but which will be under threat. So the very big danger is that under the guise of helping, and again, to the extent that some of this help is given, it's welcome. But under that cover, we can expect that down the road, they will then say that the Social Security and Medicare, et cetera, are underfunded now because they're taking that money, and they will use that as an excuse to cut those programs.
So what you're telling us is that the proposal is to divert funds from Medicare and Social Security to pay for workers who can't go to work.
Yes, but it'll be done indirectly, so it won't. It's not that they're going to cut a check from the Social Security fund to do it. But it will be indirectly by underfunding, by absolving the corporations from having to pay into that fund. So it will be done indirectly and essentially secretly.
And
actually, the Trump administration wanted to go even further. And as often happens with Trump, is that what the more sophisticated power structure likes to do quietly, he has a tendency of blurting it out and making it obvious. So he or his administration tried to put into the bill, and will still try in the Senate probably, a general cut of the payroll taxes. So not just for the specific monies that are being paid for sick care and family care, but entirely, which would make it much, much worse.
You're listening to the voice of Dr. Cohen, Doctor of Public Health and Professor of Epidemiology and Population Health at Albert Einstein. I'm Johanna Fernandez, host of It's a Good Day, and we're going to start taking calls. It's 741. Please call us at 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877 for calls, for questions and comments about the situation we're in. And I'd like to ask you, before we take a call that has just come in, if you were empowered to develop and implement a public health policy for this moment, what would its elements be?
Well, the key thing is that whatever we do, that we have to take care of people who will be impacted economically and socially, that we cannot forget them, and them is us. We hear the mantra on the cable news shows, politicians all saying it, and it sounds good. We're all in this together. But sometimes and often, when they say we, they forget a big section of the we, and that includes the poorest, the people who don't have, who already don't have jobs, or if they do have jobs, are underpaid and don't have adequate jobs, and now they're going to lose those jobs. And these are precisely the same folk who don't generally have paid sick time, who are living paycheck to paycheck, which is about half the country, and have no reserves to fall back on. So that all the mitigation activities, whether it's when you keep people home from school, who's going to take care of the kids? When you tell people to stay home from work, who's going to pay the bills? We'll need a moratorium on evictions. We need a moratorium on foreclosures, on repayments of student loans, on repayment of auto loans, stop the repos of the cars, and so on. This is an emergency situation, and it's going to be evolving as the cases become more numerous and hopefully slower, but everybody expects to be more cases, more serious cases, and including some deaths. And it's going to evolve how the immediate responses we have to take.
Dr. Cohen.
Overall, we have to take care of people who will be adversely affected.
Dr. Cohen, we've got quite a number of calls.
Sure.
Caller WBAI, Johanna Fernandez here with Dr. Cohen. Your name and where you're calling from.
I don't know if you're talking to me. My name is Dan. I'm calling from Lodi, New Jersey.
Good morning, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'd like to compliment Dr. Cohen on his compassion, that you can tell it very evidently in his voice, and his willingness to criticize openly how the public interest always is given a back seat to Wall Street's profiteering. Most doctors, I'm sure, would not go on record saying that, and it is really a breath of fresh air that he does that, as well as pointing out the practical ways to help people in this time of crisis. So I'm very appreciative of Dr. Cohen's sentiments.
Thank you so very much. Dr. Cohen?
Well, let's go to another question.
Caller, WBAI, your name and where you're calling from.
Oh, yes. Hi. My name is Mel from Manhattan.
Welcome,
yeah,
Mel.
Yeah, very good show, I have to say. Excellent. I don't think people recognize the fact that the United States is bankrupt. We have a national debt of up to $20 trillion. That's just the tip of the iceberg. We have foreign trade deficits running about 45 years with other countries of somewhere in the neighborhood of $30 trillion. We have a Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid debt, probably another 40, 50 trillion, maybe estimated conservatively 80 to 100 trillion. Most people say it's even higher, maybe 200 trillion. We're basically bankrupt, and that's why we have President Trump, because he's very good at declaring bankruptcy. He's a master at thievery and lying, and he's excellent at what he does. You have to give him credit for that. The man is an excellent thief and liar. Because he put it, he got himself elected, or maybe through chicanery, perhaps. That's another story. We have a rigged system. It's like professional wrestling here. Our electoral system is no different than the professional wrestling. It's all totally rigged, including the Democrats and the Republicans. We're in deep trouble, and not only here, our whole world is in deep trouble. Bolsonaro Brazil is just another example of the same mentality. We have an authoritarian regime in Hungary now. Poland, Germany's moving to the right. The right-wing parties in general are moving across in the world. We're heading into deep trouble.
Thank you very much.
Our ecology is shot, and they won't admit it. Most of the tipping points have been passed. People don't know that.
Thank you very much, Mel. We appreciate your comments. And Dr. Cohen, can you comment on... Yes.
Make a more general comment. This is a terrible crisis, and there's a cliche that crisis is both danger and opportunity. The danger is obvious. The opportunity is double-edged. The corporate interests are going to very much, like they do with every, as the shock doctrine has explained and others have explained, they will try to use this crisis to squeeze people more, to use the debt crisis to squeeze more, to reallocate income and wealth from the poorest to the wealthiest. And even things like surveillance, which is necessary, we call in epidemiology, we talk about disease surveillance, but they will try to impose police surveillance and will try to strengthen the police apparatus and the military apparatus using this crisis as justification. But there's another side. We have another opportunity. This crisis is laying bare for all to see how our system is not working for the great mass of people, the great many millions of what we call the 99%. And to the extent that we can, the social justice movement can use what's happening to try to explain to folk how it doesn't have to be this way, whether programs like the Green New Deal or programs, things that the progressive candidates are talking about, it's become part of the conversation. Even the notion that paid sick leave and paid family leave should be a human right, just like all medical care should be a human right. These are issues that are now becoming mainstream, and we need to use that opportunity to say it doesn't have to be this way. It's a wealthy country. The problem, we're not bankrupt in the real wealth sense. It's a financial bankruptcy. Real wealth is there. The problem is it's in the wrong hands.
Thank you. We have another caller. Caller, WBAI, tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Yes, good morning, Johanna. This is Fidel from Jersey City. And my question is for Dr. Cohen. Please bear in mind, this is not an endorsement. We are in an election cycle. Some of us witnessed yesterday a pretty incredible debate where fundamental differences were shown to us on these two candidates. So I understand that you have very dire predictions for the future. However, as we know, not everything is set in stone, and we can certainly, in many cases, reverse course. So my question is to you, based on the two primary candidates of the Democrat Party, and once again, this is not an endorsement, it's just an observation, an educated observation from you. Which one of the two candidates do you think is more qualified to tackle all the problems that you have laid out in front of us and at the same time go head-to-head and beat Donald Trump. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Fidel.
Okay.
Dr. Cohen.
I think it's clear to anyone who listened that the positions that Bernie Sanders is raising, he's raising the issues, the concerns, very similar to what I've been raising, and showing how it's necessary to totally restructure how we go about daily life and how we're going to meet this crisis. Of course, I think he would be the first to recognize that one person alone certainly would be a huge improvement if he was elected. But even if elected, one person alone can't change these things. This is a question of building a social justice movement that can challenge the way things are run, the entire structure. And I think Bernie Sanders' presentation points that out, but it goes even beyond getting him elected, which will be very difficult because they're all going to line up against him. But no matter what, we have to build that social justice movement if we're going to sustain the gains that we need to make.
Caller, thank you so very much, Dr. Cohen. Caller, you're on the line, WBAI. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Ms. Fernandez, how are you doing? My name is Christian. I'm from Parkchester, the Bronx.
Ooh.
Not far from where you grew up.
Sir, I grew up in Parkchester, yes. In fact, the Grand Concourse, my parents moved to Parkchester later on. But tell us, what's your name again?
Christian.
Go ahead.
I don't think a lot of people don't understand how bad the situation is. Like, I took the 12 bus from University Heights, just, you know, back to Pelham Parkway. And the amount of people that were still touching handlebars and on their smartphones still, it just baffled me because the situation is so bad right now. Joanna, I was actually traveling the last 3 days. I went to Massachusetts. I went to Edmonton up there, you know, see a couple of people I knew. There's no sanitizer or toilet paper left in all the stores in Massachusetts, upstate New York. And we have a sea town here. I got back yesterday. We have a sea town here on Union Court. So toilet paper sold out at the stores right around where I live here. And people don't realize how bad this is. And so I don't know how bad it's going to get, but I have about, I say, 4 rolls of toilet paper. I have about 4 bottles of sanitizer that I've been using. So, and my employee said, we don't go back to work till March 30th. But if this gets worse, that date could be pushed back because people are getting definite dates to go back to work. But this, the amount of cases is still rising.
Christian, so are you getting paid for those weeks, these 2 coming weeks, that you're not working?
Actually, no, nothing has been implemented yet.
Dr. Cohen, nowhere is poverty more apparent today than in the Bronx. A third of Bronx residents live below the poverty level. Can you give us perspective on these concerns?
Well, I think it was a Christian put his finger on it because at least in those 2 aspects. One is that for those who are going to have to continue to work, who are not going to be told to stay home or allowed to stay home, they're going to have to keep going to work, and how are they going to get there? I used to take the number 12 bus to work, and whether it's that bus and all the trains, these are really very close quarters. So even just getting to work, let alone being at work, creates a very big danger of and goes against the social distancing that we're trying to accomplish. With respect to the Bronx is one of the epicenters of diabetes in New York. The Bronx is also, at least the South Bronx, is sometimes called Asthma Alley in the Mott Haven section. With the Cross Bronx Expressway with, I think there are 1,000 fresh direct truck trips every day spewing diesel fumes into the air and contributing to the asthma that, that hurts people. So that I think the Bronx, but really all the neighborhood, working class neighborhoods, but the Bronx in particular has already been and is already under threat for health conditions, the environment and the economic as well as the physical environment. This is going to make it worse. I agree that, you know, when we say how bad things are, it can sometimes make people feel not only anxious or depressed, like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? We will get through it, but there's going to be a lot of pain. And what we need to do is to try to build the communities of self-reliance and support and demand that the government take more action, not just in the crisis, but in the days and weeks following the immediate crisis, because this crisis is not just the epidemic, but it'll unfold. And I don't want, when I say just, it's not just, it's a very serious issue, but it's going to unfold into a continuing economic crisis that is going to have very long-lasting effects.
Dr. Cohen, I'd like to echo the sentiments of our previous callers. We love you. We love you because it is rare to listen to a professor and doctor with this critique of our medical system and the capitalist system in which we live. Thank you for speaking so clearly and for upholding the notion that in order to save us, we have to build our communities and social movements and social justice movements that are going to prioritize life over profits. You're listening to, and you've been listening to, the voice of Dr. Cohen, Doctor of Public Health and Professor of Epidemiology and Population Health at Albert Einstein Medical School in the Bronx. Thank you so very much for joining us, and thank you for your work, Dr.
Thank you
Cohen.
For what you do, and thank you for WBAI, which is an incredibly important institution.
That's the end of our show for today. You've been listening to Non-Corporate, listener-funded, Peace and Justice Radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. This show is produced by Jürgen Ostensen, Ajamo Sankofa, and Shandani Smith. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator, and if you'd like to become a buddy of this show, please do. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for tuning in. It's a good day. See you tomorrow.
Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, or the times they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. 'Cause the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much for tuning in. Democracy Now! Is coming up in just a moment. Don't forget, the bylaws vote is upcoming. You have to have your ballot in by